lucky enough to be joined by Stella panel tonight, which includes one of the newest members of 36 Chambers, which is Deborah Dynan Haywood, who also, of course, sat on the Farquhar Committee, and is going to tell us all about that. And we're also joined by the ever popular and returning guest, Dave Emerson, my colleague. And just to let everybody know, both Dave and Deborah also sit as judges, so we're going to be hearing from that perspective as well. So if I can turn to you, Deborah, first of all, just to say, how did these discussions on efficiency come about? How were you selected for the committee, and what made the cut from your discussions?
Okay, well, good evening, everybody. So as a deputy district judge, I was at the inaugural launch of the Financial Remedies Court back in early 2021. I think it was maybe January. And Mr. Justice Peel was doing a talk. And as everyone was gathering, as they have been this evening, Mr. Justice Mostyn was there. And Judge Farquhar said to him, just sort of thinking aloud, "So, Nick, you know, what's going to happen when we're all back after COVID? Is it all going to be, you know, back to the same as it was? Or, you know, can we keep some hearings online?" And so Mr. Justice Mostyn said, "Well, I don't really know, Stuart. You know, why don't you set up a committee and then have us a think about it and tell me what you think?" So that's what Stuart Farquhar did. And he approached the lead financial remedy judge in Bristol, who is Her Honour Judge Cope. And she put my name forward as being somebody who was an experienced financial remedy practitioner and sits as a deputy district judge. And I tend to seek out financial remedy lists for obvious reasons, because that's my comfort zone. And so Stuart then set up this committee, and what he wanted to do was to have a diverse committee that didn't necessarily comprise of, sort of the usual names. So it's very diverse nationally, it's diverse in terms of people's practices. Some are very high net worth, some are in sort of less, you know, more modest circumstances, and most of the committee members have at least two hats, so recorder, barrister, solicitor, deputy high court judge, etc. So we could come at it from a couple of different angles. And there are two Farquhar reports. There's one which people don't really know a great deal about. We did it at the same time as a competing Lord Justice Baker report. So, and actually they said quite similar things in terms of smaller hearings carrying on being remote, larger hearings back into court at some stage. And then there was also a Nuffield report as well. So we had a lot of competition for that paper. But we did do two surveys. One was to all practitioners, including and litigants in person, and the other one was just to judges. And so the Farquhar 2 is the report that came out in October, which led to the efficiency statement. And really, the Farquhar committee and what they've done is split into three, really. One area is what was a good idea, what we thought should happen in terms of changing the system, but needed a rule change. And we might talk about it later, but in particular, fast track system, and talking about the levels of what should be in and out of that fast track system. And so that needs a wholesale rules change. So that's not in at the moment. Then we had the changes that we could bring in without a change of the rules that led to the efficiency statement and the primary principles. And they're what came into effect on the 11th of January. And then we sort of have our cutting room floor, really, in terms of recommendations that we discussed that we thought the committee thought was a good idea, but when it went to the lead financial remedy judges, which is sort of like the, you know, House of Lords equivalent, they weren't so keen. So things like having an advocates meeting before a final hearing, it just, you know, it's probably a nice idea, but it's not terribly practical. So that was not taken on board.
So are you able to tell us what recommendations are coming in later?
I think the main one is the fast track one. We had these two surveys. One, as I say, was a wider, I think we had about 900 responses to that one, and the financial remedy judges one. And what our research showed was that, and we looked at pre-pandemic for obvious reasons, 30% of cases were settling prior to the FDR. of the 70% that went through then to the FDR, 50% of those cases were settling at or just after the FDR before the final hearing. And it was taking 55 weeks to get to an FDR, so over a year on average, and on average 84 weeks to get to a final hearing, so more or less sort of a year and a half-ish. And so we then started looking at how the system is clogged. And one of the problems is that those more modest asset cases are taking up a big proportion of the actual number of cases going through the system. They may not actually be easier because there's less money to go around, so there's more stretching, but they don't need the delay that is inherent in a lot of the bigger cases where you need experts, etc. So that was the one thing that came out of the judicial survey, which was a sort of snapshot of 2 weeks in August, September. So we then looked at the limits, and 25% of contested cases are under £250,000 net assets. 50% of the cases, i.e. half of the cases, are £500,000 or less. And then about 25% are over a million. And so we spent an inordinate amount of time talking about whether we would be recommending a cutoff of 250 or 500. We settled on 250. But that will need pilot schemes, I think, in three areas of the country. It will take about a year for that to report back. So that's a long way off actually being put into effect. But we've done some research and we hope that it will be, because it should then just speed up the system, really, and allow more cases to go through. And Fiona, you were talking about the judicial availability, and for people who don't sit, judges, recorders and district judge, deputy district judges can either sit locally or they can actually put themselves into the national pool. So if you haven't availability in your regular sitting slot, you can actually go to other places in the country. And every 3 weeks, the list comes out of the vacancies, and it is eye-watering. I mean, obviously they're not all financial remedy lists, but a lot of them are. And that list for a three-week period runs into thousands. So it is deeply worrying. And if we can get it, some of the cases out of the system, then that's got to be to the good of everybody.
So just to recap, what you're saying is that anything under 250 would be in the fast track in the future.
Be in the fast track, which is basically so that your first hearing is an FDR, your second hearing is the final hearing, and to make sure that the FDR has plenty of time, because that's been one of the issues, just not having enough time. So you've got a judge who's got, you know, probably less than an hour. The judge gives you the benefit of what they think about the case, off you go. And if you're remote, you're just not invested, or your client's not invested in particularly getting to grips with it and trying to resolve it. So these FDRs need more time, but probably less court appointments.
Yeah. So can you tell us what didn't make the cut, and anything you were disappointed not to see brought in? Because I know there was a few things.
There were. I mean, for me, I think the advocates meeting, I think I'm always quite envious of care practitioners who are able kind of discuss the case, have that meeting beforehand, really have that opportunity. Whereas I think financial remedy practitioners, sometimes, you know, we don't see the briefs until very late in the day. There's only a limited amount of that you can do when you're getting the papers for a case that's, you know, say in a few days time. Whereas if you have that meeting beforehand and all the advocates are meeting, I think that's probably a better way of having those pre-court discussions, particularly for an FDR or a private hearing, final hearing. But it is an extra expense, and where we're trying to cut down on the expense where we can, I completely understand that that wasn't something that was necessarily adopted. So the lead financial remedy judges weren't keen at the time.
Wasn't there, didn't you want shorter statements as well?
I personally wanted much shorter statements, because I think sitting as a deputy district judge, I don't have a great attention span. After about page four, maybe I shouldn't say this, but after about page four or page five, they all begin to blur. And if you've got a limited amount of time, you've got parties literally coming through the door or on the screen, statements that go on for pages and pages, or you know, position statements, you're just going to start skimming them. And it certainly changed the way I, as a practitioner, formulate my position statements, So gone are the days of hours and hours of crafting every single word. It becomes very far more broad brush, because I now know sitting that judges do not have the time. And actually, it is more broad brush. And so if you limit the page number and make them relevant, then that's doing everyone a favour, really. So yes, well, anyway, it's longer than I wanted.
You heard it here first, if you before Deborah.
Yes, sorry about that. So
if I can turn to you, Dave, and Hero, if you can comment on this as well. What do you think are the overarching implications for solicitors' practice of the efficiency statement? Dave, you're on mute.
There is, I think, that there's, for those who want to continue litigating, the implications are that there's obviously much more front loading of work. We're going to have to do much, much more before the FDA. We're going to have less opportunity for tactics, although I don't think they're going to disappear completely. We've got to tell our clients it's going to cost more. So we're going to be expecting them to pay more money on account, both for the solicitor's fees and the barrister's fees leading up to the FDA. I think, at Anthony Gold, we're in the process of drafting some standard letters that give the client a good idea about what the efficiency statement is and what it means. And critically, a draft letter to go to a litigant in person that tries to explain to them what it is, but also to be encouraging to them to try and help and comply. Joint letters, standard joint letters for the valuations, letters for the mortgage capacity. All of that is going to change the way we work in practice. But I think
that's the sort of thing. Sorry, to just thinking about it, that would be a really good thing to have standardised across the board, like the asset schedule that's coming in, wouldn't it? Joint letters, because they're just the silliest thing to spend money on, arguing back and forth.
Well, the standard letter to the mortgage broker giving all the details, it must be something that the FLBA and resolution ought to be able to come up between us. But I think the overriding take from me with the efficiency statement is they don't want us in the courts.
Yeah, that's what I think as well.
The waiting time to get to an FDA is six months, something like that, in practice. Waiting for an FDR is going to be even longer. And I don't know, Deborah, whether you were there, that there was the Financial Remedy Judges Conference last September, where part-timers and full-timers were there, if anyone with a complex financial remedy ticket was there. And although Chatham House rules prevent me from saying who the key judges were saying this, but they were saying in London and the South East, they reckon that something like 50% of the cases are not going through the courts. They're finding their way into private FDRs and mediation and so forth. And that's got to be the way to go, because you're not going to get satisfaction through the courts unless it's a really complex case or there's domestic abuse issues.
I think it's so hard for us to be able to tell clients, though, the difference this is going to make, because they only ever come to you once, well, what you hope once, and so they're not going to appreciate that this is a new situation that makes it much worse and more costly, and because it always sounds costly, it always sounds bad to them, so I'm not quite sure how we will explain that, but I don't know if anybody else got any other thoughts.
I mean, I think it will make people more focused on settlement early on. But it will front load the costs
massively.
And have things, having to agree the value of the matrimonial home and things like that. And if we can get those things agreed earlier, then that should help us to settle cases sooner. I'm not sure about the needing to be in person. I think that actually increases costs quite a lot because you tend to do a lot of sitting around. Most of my cases, the clients were abroad anyway. And they can still be really focused on settlement. And in the past, when we've had to drag people over from somewhere far away and they've perhaps had to leave children without having any family members there, they've actually been exhausted and stressed at having to come over, and it's actually had the opposite effect. So I still think, I think there will be some flexibility still. That's the guidance that seems to have been given. But I think in-person certainly increases costs.
On the in-person point, I know that there's about to be something coming out formally that says that from the 1st of March, all new issued cases are to be default in person. And then in individual circumstances, you can obviously approach a judge for exemptions or if you think a case would be better managed remotely. In terms of obviously clients who are abroad or out of the jurisdiction, what I think they're going to say is, well, that's not a good enough reason in and of itself to have a remote hearing and that it should take place on a hybrid basis so that hopefully the person who isn't there attends remotely, but the expectation is that everybody else who can should be there in person. I mean, I have had an increasing number of cases where if we haven't settled at the FDR and it's a case where, you know, borrowing capacity and housing needs is one of the major issues, we have directed it on the basis that there's to be a jointly instructed independent financial advisor to provide their view on both parties' mortgage capacity. Because at that stage, if you're going to a final hearing, it does help narrow the issues and it does help focus things. But the point is that you are essentially setting back the cost of that expert to a point in time at which it becomes really necessary. So I do entirely see what Hero and David are saying about the fact that this is going to mean that costs are incurred for clients at a much earlier stage of proceedings when otherwise they could be avoided until absolutely necessary.
Yeah. So I'm coming back to you, Hannah, again, just to open up a can of worms about the new asset schedule and how have you found experience.
Well, it is a difficult one. I know there are jokes that are made about, you know, barristers being incredibly precious about their asset schedules, and as with all jokes, they're funny because there is an element of truth to that. They are a real personal source of, you know, pride for a lot of people. They take up an awful lot of time and a huge amount of work goes into them, but for the reason that the new ES2 is precisely designed to avoid, which is that we do them in such a way that presents our client's case in a really favourably persuasive manner. The capacity to do that now with the ES2s is removed with the aim that these become more neutral and therefore of more assistance to judges. And I totally can understand the sentiment behind the ES2. There is one case I did, it was a private FDR, so it was managed slightly differently outside of the court arena, where we were able to present an agreed asset schedule to our private FDR judge. And it essentially made the case settleable in circumstances where I don't think it would have done otherwise. And having an agreed asset schedule definitely makes things easier. I would say the ES2 is much more helpful in lower value cases than high net worth value cases. The complexity of assets, nature of assets, need to be flexible in terms of, you know, currency conversions. If you've got hypothetical assets, kind of deferred profit, deferred shareholdings, that's very, very difficult to represent. It's also very difficult to get a real identification between liquid and illiquid assets because of the way that the business interests are dealt with. My own very personal gripe is the fact that we've got this joint column, which I've always steered clear of in my asset schedules, as opposed to a totals column, because it's very, very difficult with that separate to actually figure out who's got what. Mm. That being said, I have had a case where I've input my figures, I've sent it to the barrister on the other side, and it did make it a lot easier to identify where we were apart. And if anything, it identified that where we were apart didn't really matter that much. And it wasn't something that we needed to focus on. And it meant that we didn't waste the first 10, 15 minutes of the FDR taking the judge through tediously every single figure that was in dispute. I think there needs to be a better understanding as well in the income section. I think it's a great idea to have incomes represented on the asset schedule, but I don't see the use of having a mixture of gross and net figures, because that doesn't really tell you anything about, in real terms, you know, what your client is taking home in their pocket. So I think everyone is really doing their best, I have to say, to get to grips with them. The fact that they came out with immediate effect was quite tricky, particularly with a lot of the cases that have followed imminently. But I do understand that, totally understand the sentiment behind them. And I suspect that, and again, Deborah can help with this, that given the amount of backlog that the courts are dealing with, this is a huge piece of the puzzle that will hopefully make cases easier and quicker for judges to deal with, which is essential if we are going to improve the service that the court provides for our clients.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to tell everyone as well, Deborah, you've said that you sent people out, haven't you, if they haven't got the ES2, right?
Yeah. So I gave a talk on Monday to some judges on the East Midlands in terms of enforcing this. And I was doing a financial remedy list on Monday and just said, basically, no ES2. I kind of less worried about the ES1, but no ES2, no hearing, go outside. Because somebody at some stage has got to come up with one asset schedule. So, and it's not going to be me, it's going to be you. So I'm going to put this case back for half an hour. You're going to, you know, come up with some figures and then we'll get going. So how do you sanction this? Well, you either do it in costs, but that's not necessary. You know, it might be a bit over the top. Far better that you send them out, use the time, have the ES2, and then get going with it.
If you think how familiar we are all with Form E's, and judges know how quickly to assimilate the information and go to, once we're getting used to this form, it is going to be far easier for all of us to find out where we are. And I'm sure it's going to be adapted and amended over a period of time. But the uniformity must help us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so Dave, can I come back to you about mediation? Actually, can I also say, if anybody's got any experience of the ES2 they want to discuss, put it on the chat. So yeah, Dave, you're a mediator as well as a judge, and wondered if you could share how you think the ES2 can fit into ADR.
Well, I've started a few mediations since it came out, and I've used that as the pro forma, because it helps the client see things in a more neutral way. And again, there's going to be a familiarity with it, and the solicitors involved in the mediation are likely to be appreciative of it too. So I think it all helps.
Yeah. Have you used it, Hero, in mediation?
I haven't yet, but I think it is also a really good idea, and I will use it in future because it just means instead of doing the normal financial summary, you could use that, or at least have that as well as a narrative summary, and then it saves costs if they don't settle in mediation.
And again, if anybody wants to tell us about them using it in mediation on the chat, please do.
Interesting, Claire Burton said that in a case she's involved in, a judge has allowed counsel to use their own asset schedules going forward in a complex case.
Yeah.
I think that's the crucial thing here, which is that the sentiment and the motivation behind this, and ultimately, as you say, to have a neutral sort of pro forma so that we know what we're looking for, is gradually just going to make everybody's jobs easier. But it is the need for that internal flexibility, and for, you know, judges and parties to say, actually, look, this case in particular, whether it's because of the assets or the issues, is just not going to be best served by this one size fits all type of schedule.
Yeah. So Deborah, can I now ask you about the new D81 and how did that link in with your committee discussions?
Well, in the Farquhar one, we discussed the D81 because it really was an unworkable document. And I don't know if people know what happens when you put in your consent order online and you wait for the deputy, usually the deputy judge, to sort it out. So if I just explain what happens, if you're sitting there doing a financial remedy list, I don't know if it's the same in Dave in the courts that you sit in, but usually you get an email every so often from the lead financial remedies judge who says, look, the backlog is getting out of control. We've got, consent orders wanting to go through the system for Christmas. Can everybody just, you know, just take 10 and just, you know, get through them? And so usually at the end of a list, you might say, okay, I'll do a few. And what was happening was that the D81 was such an incomprehensible document, and it didn't tell you, it didn't leap off the page in terms of the questions that you wanted answered. And this is going to sound really, really bad, but what basically happens is if you've allocated 10 cases to deal with in half an hour, and you've got two decent firms against each other, putting in a D81 and a consent order, you're more likely to go, yeah, that's going to be fine. They'll have thrashed out the issues. If you've got one solicitor against one litigant in person, you might sort of give it a bit more attention. If you've got two litigants in person and one party may be wrapped with gills or just, you know, want to disappear, you're going to look at the imbalance a lot more. And often we're looking at the D81 and it just was rubbish. And so you then have to go back into the system, find the for me, find that summary of the for me, and then compare with the consent order and think, oh, okay, what's going on? And so probably out of 10, I'd be calling back at two or three to say, you're going to have to explain this. This looks unfair to me. And of course, that actually is more cost, because sometimes I might get a solicitor, there might be a solicitor in the background, you then get a letter. And then what happens is they rock up in front of you in some description, and they're very cross as to why the court hasn't made the consent order. And then they say all sorts of things that actually should have been in front of the court when I or somebody else was looking at that consent order. And they say things like, well, so-and-so was just about to get a new job, or there was an inheritance just about to receive. And you're like, oh, well, okay. Well, if you'd said that, it would have been fine, wouldn't it?
Is it box 9, Deborah, that I always love to fill in and tell them all the extra bit,
but people do.
I like to throw the kitchen sink in at that.
Yeah,
point.
That's much better. That's a really good practice. But so many people, I mean, I've seen so many D81s in the last week where only one side have filled it in. And then, you know, you have the rigmarole of sending out orders saying, respondent, where's your side? Oh, I sent it into the court. So this new form, you can use the old and the new form until the 18th of February, then it's got to be the new form. It's 23 pages as opposed to 6. It does complement the online system. It's meant to echo the message of the efficiency statement. I think it does. It's meant to ensure that judges can get through more consent orders, which I think we can. And it answers the questions hopefully the judges are asking in terms of, you know, the net effect, what are the current incomes, what's the impact of CMS or interim maintenance, where's everyone going to live? Judges are very exercised about there being equality, more or less, of housing and meeting people's needs. If you want to have a massive mortgage, you want to go and live in a palace, that's fine. But let's look at what you need to sort of have your basic living costs met. And so it's answering those questions. So it is more expensive, I completely understand that, but it will lessen the number of times that people like me say, I'm sorry, you're going to have to rock up and explain this because I don't understand it.
So what's your advice where you don't particularly want your client to settle a case? In fact, you've advised them not to. How on earth do you fill out the D81 without giving the game away?
I think you do. I think you do have to give the game away. You have to justify it. I had a case in the week where basically the assets were 300,000. Wife was getting 298,000 and she's giving the husband 2,000, and it was chucked out of court. They came into court, and of course then they were able to explain. I said, I'm still not happy. And it's that fine balance between sort of Rademacher versus you know, is this fair, but they convinced me. But yeah, it is difficult.
And I think it is telling, isn't it, that this was a form that was flawed, because my standard piece of advice to any solicitors that I was working with in the process of lodging a consent order where a settlement had been reached in proceedings was just accompany it with a covering letter.
Yeah.
Now that in and of itself shows that the form was not fit for purpose if it was always going to require additional correspondence. And I do think that in upfront, if you've got a lengthier process, but that will stop, as you say, the need for there to be multiple further court hearings and judges being worried about, is this fair? Do I need to hear more about this? Because this could be an entirely different session in and of itself, but it does raise that policy issue of the balance of, is it right that the court has got this ultimate discretion to say, well, I know that might be what you want to do, but no, sorry, I'm not going to do it. Or should we be in a system whereby actually the party's autonomy should be the ultimate thing that's respected? But I suspect that if we start going down that discussion now, we'll be here for hours.
I think anything that addresses the page 2 schedule where you have to put in the figures, because that is always like, at what point are you taking those figures?
Yeah.
You know, if you... I have a case at the moment I was telling you about before where the party split up 20 years ago. What on earth do I put in that column? Yeah. We're not splitting what the parties have now.
Yeah.
My case is that my client deserves a clean break because he's already dealt with this, but I've got no idea what figures I can put in there.
And actually, Claire and Lucy on the thread have both made great points, which is that it is very, very helpful to avoid a situation where queries are raised on settlements by the court, because it is, you know, they've both said they've had circumstances where people then wrote back on agreements that have been reached. It triggers notices to show cause applications, and it is, as Lucy said, a green light to renegotiate. So if it also clamps down on that, those sorts of further issues, then it's a false economy to say, oh, this one long form is going to make it more expensive, if you look at the hypothetical problems that actually it could be avoiding.
What do people think about whether you can then say, well, this is a binding agreement and the court should order it? Is if the court have said no, I've got a situation where mine has come back to me, even though we put a letter in explaining why it's not equal, and we've got to go along for a hearing. But if the husband then goes back on it, I don't know to what extent we can say, well, look, this is a binding agreement and the court should have to make it. Obviously, we'll have to try that.
I think I've only ever had one bounce back where that happened, and I knew it wasn't particularly fair because my client didn't want to give a pension share to the extent that he was going to have to. I mean, the judge said basically you need to give a better pension share, so we had to renegotiate. I mean, you're completely and utterly hamstrung if a judge has said this is not fair. You can't possibly try and push through the deal.
No.
Because the client might not want to pay to go to a hearing, then you're like, well, where are we? Do I offer a tiny bit more? Where is the parameters?
Well, the one on Monday,
I mean, usually given a letter which you can barely understand from the judge. No offense. You get the letter from the judge, it's quite often just a really sort of just a very
one
abrupt couple of sentences that doesn't. Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't even really make sense to you what's actually being said what the problem is. Because, you know, we as solicitors like to go into great detail as to why we've arrived at an opinion, but a judge will just be like, bang, and you've got no way of contacting that person to say,
And there's also another problem, Fiona, actually, which is that one judge will look at it online and say, no, I'm going to chuck that out. And it'll come in front of somebody else's list, and they go, well, I wouldn't have chucked it out, but you know, my colleague did, so we better go through this exercise of you explaining. And just like, oh, it's just, you know, so I think the D81, it's not perfect. I'm sure it'll be improved over time, but it's got to be better, but it will be more expensive.
It is interesting that the form and the guidance really focuses on the starting point being equality. It really does reinforce that.
So just to, because I'm aware that we've got lots of comments and probably questions, I just wanted to end on a positive note and ask Deborah, because I'm sure she's been getting a lot of flack. What can you tell us about what people have liked about the
show? Okay, what people have liked, I think the main one I'd say is the four-page questionnaire. Mm-hmm. because questionnaires they just do my head in. I just think most questionnaires are just a game. There's if you strip it down, there's probably very few questions that you actually want to know the answer to. It's all setting it up for cross-examination or making people slip up later on. So I think probably for me the four-page questionnaire maximum. Then also you're then saying to the client, look, we don't need to ask about that question, we've only got a limited amount of space, so you know, let's keep to what's relevant.
I think questionnaires are often drafted very defensively. As solicitors, we're terrified we're going to miss something, some massive sort of account sitting in Bermuda that we didn't see or something like that, so you know, we're asking completely useless questions a lot of the time. But you know, I don't know any, you know, you have to, as it's probably more as you get more experience you feel confident to drop the kind of questions, but it takes a while before you want to do that. I think it's a sister, I don't know if Hero would agree with me with that.
I think it will be helpful to have a shorter one, but I mean, in some cases you do need to have more than four pages of questions.
Yeah,
I mean, though, you're ending up with lots of schedules of deficiencies. You know, you're ending up with schedules of deficiencies running on.
Yeah, or sometimes even just all the things from the account, the payments out of an account, that can take up a couple of pages, the things that you actually do need to know where they were going.
Yeah.
It's interesting, Louise makes the point. What happens if you get a questionnaire that's 20 pages long? Do you answer, or do you stop on page four?
Stop on page four. Stop absolutely. On page four. Yeah.
Okay. And I
see your favourite questions.
That with the general theme of the new efficiency statement, and also just off the back of a lot of sort of rules changes and shifts that judges have been employing recently, I suspect it'll come out in costs. That's yeah. one way that That's these things way. will be better regulated, because I yeah. think the appetite to be more aggressive with costs as a method of really, really regulating is something that I, in my personal experience, have picked up from more and more judges that I've been appearing in front of.
Yeah, and do you think, Deborah, that people, you know, judges are making cost orders, or do you think it's a bit too fresh at the moment and people will start to do that?
I think there'll be a period of time where there will be some leniency. There's this transitional period, and I think judges will be quite relaxed about it. Of the judges I spoke to on Monday, one of the judges said, oh, she said, now I know what this is all about. I had one of those EAS ones. I didn't know what it was, but it's a really helpful document. It's like, oh my God, this has been in since the 11th of January. Let's not worry about it. So I think there will be a period of leniency, but not for everything. And one of the sort of worst things about litigation lockdown has been that page numbers, because it's all electronic, everyone's just been slinging in everything, and bundles have gone from a bit over 350 pages to now to have a bundle 1500 pages is not unusual. And so a lot of the efficiency statement just underlines what was already there and just adds some teeth to it. And I think those sort of things where the judge will say you should know better, they will not be as lenient.
The judges have had no training on the efficiency statement at all. They received an email with a covering letter from Mostyn saying that this is it.
Yeah, I'm really shocked.
And I think that's one of the difficulties, because I've had more than one solicitor who I've been doing cases with over the last few weeks, you know, email me saying, do we need to do this? You know, and I'm saying, well, default, absolutely, yes. We're going to have to cobble this together. And I know it's going to mean, particularly for FDRs, when a lot of this work was already done in anticipation of the first appointment, and now it's having to be done again, and figures be inputted, and people, you know, it's added a lot. Because I think one of the crucial things, as well as what David said about, you know, needing to front load stuff, it's time management. It's the chronology of when you would normally get your head around dealing with putting together an asset schedule, because it's not going to work just to send, either if you do one yourself before a hearing, or if you send it to counsel with papers. If you're going to build in the time for it to be done by one party, and then time for it to be sent to the other for them to do it, and then for the comments to be agreed, that is not the sort of thing that you're going to be able to do now in just, you know, a day or two before a hearing.
But would you as counsel, so everybody on here solicitor-wise can know how best to work with counsel, is it worth when you book counsel? Because Deborah was saying that as soon as you issue Form A, you need to be getting on top of the requirements of the efficiency statement. Should we be contacting our counsel when we book them to say, you know, how do you like this drafted? I mean, you don't want to come to a point where presentationally, you know, you've gone off track, I suppose. Do you think that's a conversation worth having?
I think there will be, particularly in this transition period, there will be arguments between counsel and solicitors. The expectation of the Farquhar Committee is that it's a solicitor-driven document, and it starts from the word go. And basically every time there's a hearing, or every time there's updating information disclosed, then this ES2 goes back and forward. And so you will all be absolutely excellent at your cells that you don't fill in, your highlighted cells and all the rest of it. But the trouble with that is when counsel are presenting the case, and I had one recently where soft loans, I was saying that there were hard loans, there were loan agreements, they just weren't included by my instructing solicitor. And when I said, we're about £250,000 worth of loans, like, where the hell are they? She was like, oh, well, they weren't going to be agreed, so I left them out. So it was like, ah, right, okay, you can't really do that. That's not what it's about. And so you then start your hearing with sort of, I'm terribly sorry, it was the first appointment, so it's fine, but the ES2 is not quite accurate, just need to amend it. And I think there will be a period of time, but if the solicitor wants the advocate doing, you know, what may well be a final hearing, to be in charge of that ES2, they're going to have to be instructed a lot sooner.
Do you think, so just to recap, you're meant to put it in, and then if the other side doesn't agree, they just write a comment.
Yeah, because you can change it. It's far better to put more in, and then when it goes to them and you can see, you know, some things you will be able to concede. If you leave it out, that's disastrous, because as far as the other side's concerned, well, you've just conceded it.
Yeah. Okay.
I was going to pause there, but I mean, what I was about to say addresses something on the chat, because we've had loads of really, really interesting questions. So I think it would be good to spend a little bit longer dealing with them, because this is obviously a topic that everyone...
I will hand over to you, Hannah.
One thing I was going to say is Claire's final point there, you know, that solicitors are stuck between a rock and a hard place at the moment, because there is an awful lot of criticism of costs and the costs that are being ratcheted up. And yet, this is something that traditionally I would always expect, the expectation is on me to draft the asset schedule as counsel if I'm instructed. That's one of my jobs. That's just part and parcel of my prep. I wouldn't never charge, you know, it's not something we charge extra for. It's just part of what we do. And so that, I think, is going to be a really big shift, I have to say. Obviously, even with the new ES2s, I can understand what the aim is behind them and that they're supposed to be this traveling document between solicitors. But to date, every single hearing I've done with an ES2, it's been done between myself and the counsel on the other side. So it's still been a document that's formed part and parcel of my preparation. And I quite frankly, I sometimes think that, you know, solicitors have got enough to do, in preparation for hearings, and if it's something that we can do. And as Claire says, it's just another thing that is going to mean fees go up. And then there's got to be, I think, acknowledgement that if the workload on that side is going to increase, then that needs to be reflected in an understanding of the level of fees that are going to be incurred, particularly in the cases where these asset schedules are not something that you can just knock out in an hour. They take a huge amount of process and thought and consideration if the assets are complex. So just to finish off with that, right, going back to some of the questions. So right at the start, Nusrat asked about advice on how best to decide agreeing a value of the former matrimonial home and when to do it. And I think, Nusrat, I can point you towards the efficiency statement itself, because Deborah, if I'm not wrong, it's got a very specific guidance about when it's to be done. And it says 14 days before the first appointment, the following steps should be taken. That in respect of each property used as a family home, the applicant has got the responsibility to file with the court a jointly obtained market appraisal. So essentially what you would normally provide for at the first appointment as part of the directions, i.e. get a joint estate agent market appraisal or three and take the average.
Yeah.
It is now set out what you are supposed to do and when in the efficiency statement to assist, essentially, I suppose, fast track things so that you've got those valuations noted earlier. Deborah, is that right?
All part of the front loading, and obviously to get to that part, we've had a lot of discussion about market appraisals versus red book valuations, but it's going to be quicker to hopefully get a market appraisal, and that's the whole point of it.
Another question here is about sort of the track and the fast track that you were talking about, Deborah, which I'm sure a lot of people would be interested in.
It's not in yet. It's going to take years. Okay.
Yeah. So at the moment, if let's say you've gone through voluntary for me disclosure, you can't get anywhere, and then you end up having, you know, one party issues to sort of take things forwards.
Yeah.
Possible to go into the fast track and go straight to FDR. I presume until this new regime comes in, you are stuck with the same rules that apply at the moment, which is that you can use the first appointment as an FDR by consent.
Although I don't think that really happens in practice, because by the time people have thought about it, you've contacted the court, you've seen that the judge has got 11 financial remedy cases in their list, and that's not going to work. So I think the default probably is the accelerated first appointment procedure.
Fine. Another question.
Can I just say that's Schedule 4 of the primary principles? It's all there.
Oh, super. Another question that Emma has raised, which is actually something that I've discussed a lot, which is the interplay between, obviously, we've now got these three major composite documents, the chronology, the case summary, and the asset schedule template in ES2.
Yeah.
What is the interplay between those and the requirement to still do your first appointment preliminary documents, particularly the statement of issues?
So the preliminary documents, they go. You don't need to do a statement of issues and the ES1.
Fine, that's very helpful, I'm sure, for people. I mean, I don't know if anyone's got a view about that. Personally, I always thought the statement of issues was one of the most helpful.
It's
not documents, but is the idea that the statement of issues is brought out in the other documents instead?
In the other documents and your position statement. I was against the finding of the Farquhar Committee on this, I have to say, and I think the statement of issues can be a really, really useful document as to whether somebody has flagged something up at that very, very early stage. And the number of times in a final hearing, I've gone back to that and said, well, Mr. Senator, you didn't just, you know, not raise them, why are you raising it now? Happens a lot. But I think from the judges on the committee, they just feel that you know, if we're lessening bits of paper, the statement of issues isn't particularly helpful. So maybe it's more helpful as an advocate than it is as a judge,
potentially. I want to specifically go to David and then Hero on this question, which is interesting, which is that with the sort of standardization of these sorts of documents, is there a concern you think that clients will see limited value added by solicitors and by counsel, I suppose, being involved if it's all supposed to sort of be pro forma tick box exercise type work?
I don't think so. I think these rules will be difficult for people to get their heads around. Often people just can't find these forms, and there's still going to be enough people who need you to argue their case for them properly, I think. I don't think it'll make any difference to that.
It's going to give people choice. Certainly, it does make it easier to be a litigant in person because you're guided by the form, but also the wiser people will realise that there is a style and tactics in completing the form, and they will want to pay for an expert to help them complete it.
Interesting. And moving on to this, which is something that Nigel's raised, which I do think feeds in, Dave, to what you were saying about, is this whole thing something that's going to push more and more people out of the court arena into arbitration, private FDRs and ADR, where one might assume that there would be more flexibility to do, not be sort of restricted by these documents? But Nigel's saying, you know, are we expecting arbitrators to be suggesting that these documents should be adopted as well? He's acknowledged it's discretionary, but obviously Nigel as an arbitrator set out that he suspects parties might find them easier to use once we've all got accustomed to them. And also, in the same way, Dave, that you've said, judges will appreciate uniformity, arbitrators are likely to want to make the most of the same benefits.
I think so. There's a logic to that. But the great advantage of arbitration is that you can tailor your directions and your forms to what's needed in the case and what the clients want. So I suspect arbitrators will continue to be flexible around.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that remains the case from my perspective. To force this sort of regulated approach into an arena that is necessarily bespoke and, as you say, tailor-made, and that is part of the attraction of those alternative routes, I think it would be a shame for this sort of approach to infiltrate that and then sort of undermine so much of the attraction for clients, essentially, in going down that process in the first place. I don't know if other people agree with that.
It's got to be more flexible. I did an arbitration before Christmas where I did the standard thing that I would do as I was sitting as a judge and just said, right, everybody, I need a composite schedule of assets. I need an agreed statement of what cases I should be looking at. And both counsel came back and just said, no, we're not doing that. I'm like, okay, actually, it's an arbitration. It's got to have flexibility in a way. You tell me the rules and I apply them. So if you say no, I've got to live with it.
And Sophia's raised an interesting question, which I think we've all had cases where you are sort of, you know, sort of feel like you're banging your head against the wall a little bit with the other side and lack of engagement, whether or not that's because you've got the sort of client who's just impossible to get instructions out of. What do you do with these ES documents if the other party's just not cooperating in their completion and you're saying we need to do these and they're saying, no, we're not going to bother? Do you file them one-sided?
Well, they're meant to be in the bundle 7 days before the final hearing in the FDR. So I think that as you're sort of exchanging these documents, there should be that warning that I'm just going to have to put it in a bundle or file it anyway. You need to start cooperating with this. Otherwise, it's not very helpful for the judge. judge is only going to see one side. But I think an ES2 between two litigants in person, I mean, what could possibly go wrong?
Litigants in person is obviously, I think, a really tricky one. Charles has raised the point, you know, is the court going to amend, you know, the notice of first appointment that goes out, is that going to be amended so that everyone, including litigants in person, are aware that there is now an awful lot more to do than just fill out your Form E and the FDA preliminary documents?
Yeah, that needs to happen. I'm really worried about the fact the court don't seem to know about something that came in on the 11th of January. And the forms coming out of the court at the moment still don't seem to accommodate the ES1 and the ES2, which is essential.
I'm going to turn the tables now and put Fiona on the spot, because she never has to ever chips in with any of the questions, but I'd be interested to hear what Fiona thinks about this. Because I know kind of how Fiona likes to practice, which is, are you worried that with all this increased attention on these documents, as Nigel says, are we going to lose sight of just getting these cases settled? Is it going to deflect from focusing on, we've got to do this document, we've got to do this document, ultimately, should you be thinking about, you know, making a really persuasive early open proposal to just try and get it done?
Well, that's right, because you might not have the space to actually sort of focus your mind on, right, okay, we're going to make an offer. So I can see that could emanate. But then again, it could also add clarity so that you're formulating your thoughts sooner. It'd be interesting to see which way it swings on that one, whether you just feel so rushed with all the different documents that you sort of can't get there, or whether you think, actually, this is jumping off the page much sooner. I don't know what Hero thinks of that. Only time will tell, I would say.
I was just actually going ahead and looking at a question that someone else has put on about, which I found interesting, whether paragraph 10 of the efficiency statement has to be complied with, even if you can't use the FDA as an FDR. I always thought that it did. And then I've just gone back and reread it, because Deborah said paragraph 9 seems to suggest that it isn't applicable if you're not using the first appointment as an FDR. But presumably people who've done this already are doing these steps, such as getting the valuation of the family home before the first appointment.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, so I think paragraph 9 is maybe just a bit confusing.
Deborah, how do you think the court is going to cope with allocating cases to a single judge, particularly recorders and deputies?
Well, it's really interesting. I think what will happen, and this is real crystal ball gazing, I don't really know, because if you think, I've just looked at this national availability for lack of judges for the next 3 weeks, 1,466 courts sitting without a judge in the country. So there still will be a need for deputies to be doing this type of work. The difficulty is that it's gone back to the civil docketing, which if anybody does civil knows it doesn't really work, because judges are just too busy. And so it's meant to be the same. You're meant to have judicial continuity. You're meant to have your first appointment judge and your trial judge being in effect the same. And so it comes out of that judge's work for an FDR. And then what's like to happen, I think, crystal ball, I might be completely wrong, but I think what will happen is that your deputies and recorders will be doing the FDR before it goes back in before the same full-timer as the first appointment. Because, I mean, I sit very sporadically, it suits my practice to do that, but no one's going to say, oh, it's got to be my case that I own and I see right the way through. So that would just be impractical. So I think you're going to get less deputies and recorders, but they're going to deal with the FDRs more. My prediction.
Well, it certainly didn't work in care proceedings, did it?
No.
The court list dictated everything.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to speak directly to Lucy, to her question, to reassure you, which is, you know, what happens if solicitors complete it to save costs for the client so that counsel doesn't have to, but then counsel doesn't like it? I have to say, with everyone getting to grips with this at the moment, I think it's all around a team effort, Lucy, and I would not like to think that any council would turn around and be critical of any efforts to get to grapple with this document. It's any, you know, attempt to fill it out is going to be very gratefully received, I would suspect. And as ever, these things are always a team effort behind the scenes anyway. I'm just trying to say, I'm not sure. A lot of the questions I know I haven't dealt with specifically, but that's because I think they've been dealt with as part of what we've discussed in terms of how these new documents will interplay with sort of the more traditional preliminary docs that have been ordered. I mean, someone has raised the fact that I know we've clarified, Deborah, that the new ES2s and the composite documents mean that your FDA docs are no longer required. But obviously there are going to be a discrete section of cases in a particular time period where parties have already been ordered to do that.
Yeah.
And now what do they do? Are they going to be, you know, criticized for being in breach of a court order for not doing them? Should you do both? I think people are going to have to just take a view, I think, aren't they, and do the best they can at the moment and hope that judges are sort of sympathetic and understand that the quandary temporarily that practitioners find themselves in.
You're still doing a position statement for a first appointment. You can do. The difference is it's made up of the pages in the bundle, but if you've got a statement of issues and you can incorporate in your position statement, I think that won't really matter.
Super. Well, I'm delighted to report that for the first time ever in Family Law Live history, we had well over 200 live attendees this evening, which is on the one hand absolutely brilliant, and I'm so glad that we could have this session to share thoughts, particularly from people who are involved in the profession in all sorts of different capacities, because it's extra, you know, useful to have not just solicitors and barristers, but people who, you know, with a view from the bench as well, because that always helps us. Although I'm also suspect that the reason for the number of participants is because this new efficiency statement has created quite a few waves. In that sense, it's a shame that, you know, there are so many people out there that feel the need for these sorts of support sessions. And no doubt, I think it's something that's going to take time to bed in. But hopefully Family Law Live was here to help for tonight a bit. I think I'll stop the recording. And thank you, everybody, very much indeed for joining us. And I know we'll be back next month. Don't ask me what we're doing next month, because I can't remember off the top of my head. But I know we've got something good planned. So, you know, keep your eyes peeled on Twitter and LinkedIn and things where these things are posted. And I think myself and Fiona have said, if anybody wants the recording for tonight's session, please give Danny an email, danny@36family.co.uk.
Do we have James Peary? I think we've got James Peary on next month.
Oh, yes. It's the one about collaborative working, isn't it?
I'm not sure if James is on tonight, but it is about any collaborative practitioners tonight.
Tasha's there,
as well. Tasha's on as well.
And Tasha, So please join us if you want to discuss collaborative. And I'll be posting on all my social media channels as usual.
Super. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Good night. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.